From WNYC New York Public Radio, this is The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Brian Lehrer. This is just one segment of our show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. By the way, coming up in an hour, we will have a call-in for anyone who attended the Day for Darfur rallies yesterday, either in Central Park here in New York or anywhere around the world that you happen to be listening. So a call-in for Day for Darfur rally attendees coming up in an hour. But right now, boys don't cry, go fish, kids, safe, I shot Andy Warhol, Velvet Goldmine, happiness, Hedwig and the Angry Inch, one-hour photo, Far From Heaven. What do all these movies have in common? Well, different writers, directors, and casts, yes, but they do share at least one screen credit. They were all produced by my next guest, Christine Vachon, and her independent production company, Killer Films. From Todd Haynes Poison in 1991 to the new Truman Capote film that's about to open, Killer Films has been behind some of the most distinctive American independent films, and they're still based in the East Village. Christine Vachon has written a book now, A Killer Life, How an Independent Film Producer Survives Deals and Disasters in Hollywood and Beyond. It's out from Simon & Schuster. Christine, so nice to have you on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
What defines a film as independent anymore these days? I mean, the studios have divisions to make independent films, don't they?
They do, and in some ways, those studio divisions are true oxymorons. I mean, a company like Warner Independent, for example, I think what they really mean is we want to make it cheaper. But I think what really defines an independent film is less and less to do with the money that finances it and more to do with the sort of singularity of vision that a particular film has.
So it's more a sensibility than a matter of financing. Can you even begin to put that sensibility or set of sensibilities into words?
The only real way I think I can articulate it is, you know, a genuinely, in other words, let me just skip right to in other words, a film like Far From Heaven really could have only been made by Todd Haynes, and a film like Happiness could have only been made by Todd Solondz. I mean, those are films that are absolutely specific and particular to the people that created them.
You write at the end of the book about why you think people like independent films. Can you talk about that?
Well, I think that there is something extraordinary about coming into the cinema and sitting down and a movie beginning, and in the first few moments, you feel a sense that this director has sure hands and that they're going to take you somewhere you really haven't been. And I think that's the real key to a successful independent film.
And that's the independence again. Somewhere you really haven't been. So you're not seeing a movie that's made under a Hollywood formula, but something that does something different.
Yeah, no movies by committee.
And it can do difference well or it can do difference badly. Given that theory that it's people whose lives have gone, you know, a bit differently, let's say. Would you want your daughter to get into film?
No, my daughter has to be an investment banker so that she can support me in my old age.
Right. I'm going to ask you about your next film, which is Infamous, also known as the other Truman Capote film, because like last year's Capote, it's about the writing of In Cold Blood. Is that a producer's nightmare?
You know, it's really, I have to try very hard to keep myself on the glass half full program on that film. I mean, it is a fantastic movie, and in some ways it's miraculous that Warner Brothers let us make it, even though the other one had already gone into production. And I just have to hope that great work will rise to the top. But yeah, of course, it was a nightmare.
You have these aphorisms at the beginning of your book. Would you mind reciting a few of them for us? Do you want to read the list?
I'd have to look at the book.
Here's the book.
Thank you.
I'm now leaning across the table, handing Christine Vachon a copy of her own book.
You want me to just read down
the
whole line?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okie doke. Enjoy the process, but get out of the way. Money costs money. Push for the pragmatic. It's always your fault. Money has a personality. Read variety stories backwards. The budget is not the aesthetic. Never put in your own money. Okay, sometimes it has to be your own money. Money is overrated. Did they pass the director's quiz? Identify talent and stick to it like glue. Every little picture needs a big picture. In the big picture, we need little pictures. Fight the obvious. If it's on the nose, it goes. Keep this triangle. Talent, producer, money. Never ask a question you don't know the answer to. Less money equals more control, and more money equals less control. The deal is not the thing. It's just a big part of the thing. Find the intersection of an investor's courage and cash. Do what you love. Do it consistently. Everything else will follow. Every story behind a movie that gets made is a success story, and this is the best job in the world.
Christine Vachon reading from her own new book called A Killer Life, How an Independent Film Producer Survives Deals and Disasters in Hollywood and Beyond. She has produced Boys Don't Cry, Go Fish, Kids, Safe, I Shot Andy Warhol, Velvet Goldmine, Happiness, Hedwig and the Angry Inch, 1 Hour Photo, Far From Heaven, among others. And if you want to call up, maybe you're an aspiring independent filmmaker or an actual independent filmmaker and want to call up and speak to Christine Vachon or a moviegoer or anyone else, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or email brianlehrershow@wnyc.org. So let me ask you about a couple of those that jumped out as you were reading them. Read variety stories backwards. What did you mean by that?
Well, in variety, what tends to happen is first they announce, you know, the great deal, but at the very end of the article, it tells you who are the actual deal makers in the deal. And that's really, we always skip right to that part.
And money has a personality. Is that what you said?
Yes.
What do you mean?
Well, when you're getting a film financed, you kind of need to find the right kind of money for that particular film, because in other words, you know, money is controlled by people who often have desires that are creative as well as financial. And if they don't mesh with the direction, you know, you're trying to take the film in or the director's trying to take the film in, then you're in trouble.
And yet another one had to do with being pragmatic, or I guess that's consistent with what you just said. You know, for people who might be idealists and think, well, the independent artist shouldn't worry about being pragmatic.
Well, sadly, I think that, you know, film is such a difficult way to express yourself that pragmatism is the only thing that keeps its feet on the ground.
What keeps you from moving to Hollywood and driving around in a convertible?
Well, first of all, I don't know how to drive. That's a big part of it.
You're a real New Yorker.
Yeah, I really am. And also I feel like here at least, you know, in New York, out of Hollywood, you don't have to live with the idea that movies are the only thing that matter. You know, here people do plenty of other things, and that's kind of important.
It's nice to have a life, because otherwise what do you make movies about?
Exactly.
Has working in New York changed? Well, actually, when did you start Killer Films?
I believe we started Killer Films officially in 1995.
And so that would be well after what people consider the beginning of the so-called independent film movement. Right?
Yeah, but I had started producing films well before that. We just didn't officially form our company until then.
Right. And, I mean, if we were defining independence before as an independence of vision, there were always directors who had independence of vision. I don't think we think of Hitchcock, for example, as an independent filmmaker in the modern sense of that term, but certainly he didn't walk into Hollywood and follow anyone's formula. Is there a moment that you define as kind of the beginning of the independent movement as we think of it in film?
Well, I mean, it's an extremely self-centered answer because, as you point out, there's been an independent film movement forever, but it keeps, you know, these circles keep going round, and then everybody, you know, assumes that this particular movement is the first. For the kind of independent film we're talking about, I'd say it really began to bloom, particularly in New York, in the late 80s with movies by Spike Lee and Jim Jarmusch that were being actually made here and really sort of, you know, seemed to typify that kind of, you know, alternative vision. But they also made extremely entertaining films.
And has working in New York changed much since then?
You know, it's that French proverb, the more it changes, the more it stays the same. Yes, it has, but it hasn't at all.
How, for example?
Well, I mean, look, in some ways, I'm going to answer this question more like how the film industry has changed, which is that with the advent of DV technology and films being shot not on celluloid anymore, that's really affected post-production. It's affected what you need for actual production, et cetera, et cetera. You know, in the positive sense, film crews are 100 times more diverse in terms of gender, color, race, etc., than they ever, ever were, certainly when I first started out. So that's all, you know, those are all big changes.
And can you afford to work here in the same way that you could, you know, in the beginning, or do you have to go to Canada to actually do it?
Well, I'm shooting in Canada right now.
You are.
I'm shooting the Todd Infamous? Haynes, Bob Dylan film.
Oh, you are.
No, Infamous is shot.
It's ready
opening
to go.
In a couple
yeah,
weeks.
Of course. So tell me about this Haynes Dylan film.
It's called I'm Not There, and it's, you know, it's too, you don't have enough time for me to explain
is
it all.
Is Dylan cooperating?
Yes.
I can't wait.
Yeah, it's really great.
Put on your headphones. We're going to take some calls for Christine Vachon and Trent in Manhattan. You're on WNYC. Hi, Trent.
Yes, hi. First of all, I want to congratulate you on Infamous, which I saw a Longleat press screening of, which I think is excellent. Probably, for my money, the best of the films you've produced to date. In fact, the British actor who plays Truman Capote, I think, is very likely to get an Oscar nomination and even quite likely to win it. And we, therefore, may see ourselves with two actors having won an Oscar for playing the same role 2 years in a row. I think that would be a first. My question had to do with the majority of your films have had a gay theme, or if not directly a gay theme, have been sympathetic to the situation, such as The Closeted Husband and Far From Heaven. And I'm wondering to what degree you are an openly gay woman, whether that has to do with your seeking out that kind of material or because that kind of material has sought you out. It is, in a sense, niche marketing. Certainly Go Fish was very niche marketing.
There's a lot there. Let me get an answer okay. So we can get some other questions in. I thought he was going to ask you about Jim McGreevy there for a minute.
I mean, look, obviously I think it's a combination of me seeking out material and it seeking me out. But the bottom line is, we love to do stuff that is provocative, original, and unlike anything else you've seen. And sexuality is often provocative and often original.
What makes, and Trent, thank you for your call, a person a great producer as opposed to a great writer or director? Most audiences don't even know what a producer does.
You know, I think a great producer is a combination of fearlessness, because it is terrifying, pragmatism, and the inability to hear the word no.
Inability to hear the word no. But sometimes a producer has to speak the word no.
Yes, sometimes you do. But, you know, usually what you're trying to do is pull things together against impossible odds.
Here's a follow-up from a listener who asks head-on, the word producer seems to get tossed around a lot. Please define producer. How, if at all, is that term misused? And they're really different kind. When you see producer credits on, you know, on a screen, it really can mean different things depending on the person and the role, right?
Sometimes it means, you know, the movie star's hairdresser.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, the thing about producer credits do get tossed around with, you know, insane, you know, looseness.
Sometimes it's just the financier.
Sometimes it's often. I mean, it is, when you look at some lists on some films, you'll see a dozen executive producers and maybe five or six producers, and then there's the whole, you know, plethora of associates and co-producers and blah, 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 blah. it's really hard to go through that and find the person who really got the movie on the
screen. So in your case, are you having creative debates with the director, and can you pull rank over the director about a particular shot or sequence?
But that's not the kind of producers we are. I mean, we have very collaborative discussions with the directors, but we're usually there because we believe in this director.
Tom in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hello, Brian. Hello, Christine.
Hello.
I just wanted to talk briefly, Christine, in your beginning intro, when speaking about independent film and as being a vision, I just wanted to see if you could touch on the differences maybe between, like, auteur films, like coming from a Jim Jarmusch or a Todd Solondz, in the context of independent cinema sort of in general.
Well, I mean, I guess to some degree or another, you know, the auteur theory sort of belies the idea that, you know, that there's so many other people who contribute to the extraordinariness of an extraordinary film.
The auteur theory is the singular vision of the director.
Right. But on the other hand, I feel like for most of the directors we work with, I would consider auteurs because I feel like they are the complete creators of their work.
Thanks, Tom. You've taken a little heat for saying you hate seeing movies at the Angelica
right.
in Lower Manhattan, since it shows so many independent films. Funny enough, finally a place that, you know, that focuses on what you do, and you give them a little ribbing. Why was that?
Well, I mean, first of all, in a book that's filled with, like, you know, all kinds of stories about movie stars, that's the one thing that got pulled out.
Here in Lower Manhattan. I mean,
you know, I think the bottom line is when you work so hard on a film and you make something beautiful, to show it in a movie theater where, you know, the projection isn't great, the seating is crappy, and the subway is rumbling your seat every 5 minutes, it stinks.
Do you have some favorite theaters in the city?
The Sunshine is really my favorite theater.
We've just got about a minute left. What should we do? Oh, I know. Who is this book for? Is it for people in the film world, aspiring producers? Is it for movie buffs who want some behind-the-scenes gossip? Who did you write your book for?
You know, I mean, ultimately, of course, I wrote it for me because, you know, I like the sound of my own voice, written or spoken. But but I think it's for both. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's certainly, I hope, inspiring to people who think that, you know, it's impossible to make these kinds of stories. And I hope it's a good insight into what it is we actually do.
If you like your own, quote, voice, have you thought about directing yourself?
You mean directing myself?
No,
directing?
I mean directing, comma, yourself.
You know, I've certainly thought about it, but I just don't think it's the best. I don't think I'd be that great at it.
Christine Vachon has written A Killer Life, How an Independent Film Producer Survives Deals and Disasters in Hollywood and Beyond, out from Simon & Schuster. Great to have you on. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Coming up at 11 o'clock, our special coverage of Governor Eliot Spitzer's inaugural address, beginning with a look back at the legacy of George Pataki. And coming up later this week, we will continue our coverage of the Sean Bell shooting investigation and the many questions raised by that incident, criminal and otherwise. For example, we'll be asking, can black cops be racist? That question has become an issue in the case, as two of the five officers who fired those 50 shots were black. Two others were also officers of color. We'll talk about that. But right now, I want to take the few minutes that we have before we shift into inauguration mode to replay a commentary that I aired on the station a few weekends ago and that I thought many of you who didn't get to hear it then might want to hear. This is a somewhat personal take as a white parent after the Bell shooting, musing on white privilege. A version of this also appeared as an op-ed in the Daily News and has generated a tremendous amount of response back to me most of it positive, some of it not. We invite your response via email to Brian Lehrer Show at WNYC.org. This originally aired on Saturday, December 2nd. I don't usually begin a commentary by stating my race, but in this case, I think it's necessary. I'm white. White and Jewish, if that matters. The sad reality is that to make any sense at all of last week's shooting, you have to view it through the lens of race and experience. As a journalist and a white person, my first impulse after hearing about the shooting was to look for all the details. What exactly did these cops do? What police procedures did they follow or break? Was it a tragedy or was it a crime? Let's gather all the facts before passing any judgment. But that reaction comes from the luxury, the privilege, of emotional distance. I have two sons growing up in the city, including a high school student who takes the subway by himself just about every day. Like any parent, I worry about his safety, but I don't worry that he'll get killed by the police. I don't worry that he'll get killed by a racist police officer. I don't worry that he'll get killed by a well-meaning police officer who makes a tragic mistake. Nor do I worry police will raid our home and arrest him on the pretense of an unpaid $25 ticket, as happened to one of Sean Bell's friends this week. Black parents worry about all those things. They have to worry about criminals and about the cops. On my weekday call-in show Thursday, James McBride, author of the best-selling memoir The Color of Water, recalled growing up half black, half Jewish in the same neighborhood where this shooting took place.
I grew up in Jamaica. And I remember when I was a kid, we were protesting some black kid who got shot by a cop. This has been going on for a long, long time. So when this kind of thing pops up, it doesn't matter what class you are in terms of blackness in New York. It doesn't matter whether you're upper class, or lower class, middle class. You see it, you relate to it, and black mothers this morning are waking up saying what my white Jewish mother said when she sent us off to school, was saying, please, Lord, don't let him run into the wrong kind of policeman when he's out there today.
With my white privilege, it's easy to say the police are more professional now than when James McBride was a kid, which I believe they are. It's easy to respect the dangers facing undercover cops who risk their lives in murky situations like at Club Kahlua that night. Two of them were killed recently. It's easy to call Charles Barron reprehensible when he threatens, that blacks aren't the only ones who can bleed. And I think he is. But the harder work for a white person is to understand what many of my black peers experience every day, and why their first reaction is not to calmly gather all the facts. It's not to reassure themselves that Mike Bloomberg is more sensitive to black people than Rudy Giuliani was. It's to feel the pain in their guts, to feel the rage in their bones. It's to shout from the rooftops, oh my God, they've done it again. And it's to feel so alone, because the first reaction of white guys like me is to start asking questions rather than shout along. That commentary originally aired on Saturday, December 2nd. Again, we invite your response via email to Brian Lehrer Show at WNYC.org. The inauguration of Elliot Spitzer coming up. Thanks for listening to The Brian Lehrer Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.